The title of today's presentation is Goodbye Diabetes. Now let us welcome Dr. Wes Youngberg as he tells us how to prevent and reverse diabetes the natural way.
In 1995, I was challenged by the then governor of Guam to come up with guidelines for the prevention of diabetes on Guam. And I was asked to be a co-chair on the task force for the, actually, it was the governor's re-election campaign. I mean, actually, it wasn't, but he knew how to attract attention, and he knew that one of the biggest issues on Guam was a death rate due to diabetes that was 5 times higher than it was here on the U.S. mainland. It was a critical, critical health issue. And so he decided that he was going to tackle it head on by coming up with guidelines to prevent diabetes. And as I contemplated this task, I realized that I asked myself the question, how can I come up with guidelines to prevent a condition that already has complications setting in before the official diagnosis of diabetes can be made? How do you prevent something that has already caused damage before you even meet the diagnostic criteria for the condition? And so in a few minutes, I'll show you, we, Dr. Briniger and others, we came together and put together the 5 stages of high blood sugar. It was a clinical and educational tool for physicians in the community as well as the public at large to see the problem as it began to unfold. You see, the problem with diabetes is that it actually begins its insidious attack on health many years, in fact, 2 to 3 decades before the diagnosis is actually made. And so today, and in the short amount of time that we have to really look at this topic, my goal is to kind of go through the steps that I went through in coming up with these guidelines. About 5 years ago, Dan Houghton, who's the president of Heart Research right here in Fallbrook, California, he challenged me to begin writing a book on diabetes. And I asked myself the question, well, there's so many books on diabetes, what would it really matter if there was one more book on the topic? And then, again, I looked at the question, well, it has a book been put together that looks at the insidious nature of the early phases of diabetes and then challenges this in the way that seeks to reverse it? You see, I've never been satisfied with the idea of just managing any condition. And I suspect most of you are not satisfied with just managing a situation. Yeah, you want to optimize. I had a patient come in to see me for the first time just on Friday, and I said, tell me, what brought you here? What are your goals? And she said, well, I just want to be healthy. So, you know, usually somebody comes up and has specific goals, you know, they have a condition that's been diagnosed and they want to tackle it head on. But she says, I just want to be healthy and I want to make sure that what I'm doing today is what is necessary and optimal so that I can be optimally healthy next year in 10, 20 years from now, so that I can see my children grow up and my grandchildren grow up as well. So, today we're looking at kind of a broad overview of this topic. I do a 12-week series on diabetes. That's 18 hours. And I'm actually stressed about doing a one-hour presentation on this topic. So kind of bear with me. So we're not just talking, by the way, about preventing pre-diabetes and diabetes. We're really talking about re-engineering our genetic risk for any disease. When I have a patient come in to me who has an autoimmune condition, whether it's just dry eye syndrome or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, a more advanced form of autoimmune disease, you know what? One of the first things that we need to do and address effectively, we need to see, is there an underlying blood sugar insulin dysregulation present that is interfering with the immune system's ability to work properly? See, so oftentimes when we have an autoimmune condition, we kind of suffer in silence until the pain is so significant that we're willing to take medications like methotrexate or other medications that are known to cause cancer and other serious disease, because we just need some relief from that significant pain and dysfunction. But the good news is that there are many underlying metabolic factors that influence how well the immune system works. And one of the most powerful ones is this question of blood sugar and how much insulin the pancreas has to produce in order to control that blood sugar. You see, the earliest sign of a problem isn't prediabetes. See, a lot of people think that prediabetes is just the earliest rise in blood sugar that then simply clues us into we might be at risk for diabetes. Now, it's certainly true that prediabetes significantly increases the risk for developing diabetes, but prediabetes is in of itself one of the most powerful risk factors for heart disease, strokes, and other circulatory disorders. Prediabetes in of itself dramatically increases risk. It's not just a little signpost to say, be careful, okay? It's actually a condition in of itself that's far more important than whether your cholesterol is high or even your blood pressure is high. So prediabetes is really important, but even prediabetes isn't the first sign of a problem. So let's get into defining this condition. So the goodbye diabetes really is divided into four sections where we look at, let's really understand what diabetes is. And let's really understand the early factors that build up to prediabetes and diabetes. But then also I want to actually debunk the notion that diabetes is a condition that can only be managed. We'll get into that in a second. And then probably the most important thing that I hope you take home from today's presentation is that we need to put a lot more effort into detecting, not just of diabetes, but all the metabolic imbalances that go along to drive disease and premature aging. So detection is really critical. And once we've taken the time to actually look at the data, then we can develop a strategy to defeat diabetes. But again, not just diabetes, defeat whatever health concern you might have. So how would you define diabetes? This is a question that I always ask every time I start working with a patient who has this condition or in my classes. The first thing I ask at the beginning of any of the 12 lectures I give on this topic, I ask, what's the definition of diabetes? And I'd like to propose to you that diabetes is simply having a blood sugar level so high for so long that they eventually cause significant health complications if not corrected. Okay? So the emphasis I want to place is if not corrected. In other words, we can dramatically decrease our risk for all the complications of diabetes if we simply correct not just blood sugars, but all the other risk factors that are associated with that condition. Okay, now let's look at some of the data relative to the diabetes epidemic. First of all, we look at 8.3% of all Americans have diabetes. That's the official statistic. However, that doesn't include individuals. Let me rephrase that. That only includes checking a fasting blood sugar. In other words, when we go to the doctor on a yearly basis, and I hope we all do, and we get that physical, part of the physical is a blood test called the comprehensive metabolic profile. It looks at how the kidney's doing, how the liver's doing, how our electrolytes are, how calcium's doing. It just looks at a lot of things all at once. It's a good overall indicator of how we're doing. But it's just the beginning. Part of that test includes the glucose, fasting glucose or fasting blood sugar. And if our fasting blood sugar is less than 126, we don't have diabetes by definition. If it's 100, just if it's hit 100 up to 125, that's the category of pre-diabetes. But as you'll see in a minute, there are actually two stages of high blood sugar that come prior to even pre-diabetes. We'll look at that. So if you do a test, which I strongly advise that we all do, I recommend a 4-hour glucose tolerance test. We actually go into the lab, they draw your blood, they check your glucose, the blood sugar, and then they check your insulin at the same time. Then they give you a 75-gram load of glucose. It's basically a sugar drink. It's about twice as sweet as a soda, as a regular soda. Okay, it has about the same amount of calories as a medium-sized drink. And then at half hour, 1 hour, 2, 3, and 4 hours, we recheck the sugar. And some of those time points, we also look at how much insulin the pancreas has to produce in order to try to control the blood sugars. So this is real important. Even if your blood sugar never goes up, not even into the early stages of high blood sugar, that doesn't mean that your health relative to blood sugars is perfect. All that means is your pancreas is producing enough insulin to control your blood sugars. But if your muscle and your liver are resistant to insulin, which most of us are, I estimate that between 80 and 90% of American adults are resistant, at least at some level, to how insulin is supposed to store sugar. So when the muscle and the liver are resistant to that, the sugar is going to go up unless what? Unless the pancreas makes more insulin to compensate for the fact that there's resistance to insulin storing sugar into the cells. And so what most of us do, and this can go on for many decades, even with what appears to be completely normal or healthy blood sugars, what most of us are doing is we have a pancreas that's producing 2, 3, 5 times more insulin than we should have to. I've seen individuals producing over 100 times more insulin than they should have to. So the good news is that the pancreas can produce a tremendous amount of insulin in order to compensate for the fact that the body's resistant against it. The downside is that when we produce all that insulin, that excess insulin is the number one cause of high blood pressure, a major reason to create autoimmune dysfunction in our body. It's one of the major risk factors. In fact, studies have shown that insulin resistance and its its relationship to high insulin in the blood is responsible for the majority of heart attacks and strokes. Insulin resistant and the attempt of the pancreas to make all that extra insulin to control blood sugar is one of the major causes of turning on cancer, of actually promoting the growth of cancer in our body. Just a few months ago, there was a major study that came out showing that those individuals who had diabetes and used insulin to control their blood sugars were 20 to 50% more likely to be diagnosed with cancer within 2 years. Now, many physicians who treat diabetics were really upset about this study, even though it was published in a highly respected medical journal. They were upset because cancer is not going to develop in just 2 years. I mean, a 20 to 50% increased risk of cancer in just 2 years? I mean, they've been working with patients who've been taking insulin for 20 to 30 to 40 years. And so they're thinking, if that can happen in 2 years. And so they were initially unwilling to accept that information until they started to understand or recognize that it's not saying that that causes cancer to start from the beginning and develop into cancer within 2 years. We all, from time to time, have cancer growing within us. The goal is to shut down that process and help the body fight and eradicate it as quickly as possible. And what's interesting is that when the blood sugars are out of balance and the pancreas has to make more insulin, guess what? That extra insulin is a growth factor for cancer. And so I'd like to suggest to you that as we look at this concept of saying goodbye to diabetes, in a very real sense, if we effectively manage insulin levels so well through these natural strategies, that we're also essentially saying goodbye to cancer. Saying goodbye to our personal risk for cancer. This is an important thing in my life. My mother died of cancer when I was 10. It made a powerful impression upon me. And as a young teenager, I was committed to figuring out early what my risk factors were so that I wouldn't have to go through that horrible experience that my mother went through and dying at age 39. So the good news is that once we start understanding these metabolic factors, we're not just controlling this epidemic of diabetes and pre-diabetes, we're actually dramatically controlling all risk. All risk. So diabetes is if researchers include the 2-hour blood sugar out of that 4-hour glucose tolerance test, And they see how the sugar rises after a meal or after any kind of carbohydrates. When we add that test to the standard test being used to determine how many of us have diabetes, the percentage of Americans with diabetes goes from 8.3% to 12.9%. That's a 40% increase in the prevalence of diabetes just by adding that glucose tolerance test. And so that's why I recommend that all of us should have that test done. I've had that test done many times personally. It's an extremely valuable test. And the reason I do the 4-hour test and recommend it so strongly is because it also shows us the tendency for the blood sugars to drop too low. And that picks up a condition that we refer to as adrenal fatigue, a reactive hypoglycemia, where the blood sugars may initially be high, and then after 1, 2, or 3 hours, they come crashing down, and we have this very brittle situation where the sugars are going up and then coming down, and then finally the adrenals wake up, and they produce lots of stress hormone cortisol, and that causes the blood sugars to shoot up again, and then that causes more insulin to be produced, and then the sugars come crashing down, and the blood sugars are going up and down all day long. And of course, that's causing a tremendous amount of stress on our endocrine system, various hormones, our heart, our immune system, all systems are damaged by that rapid fluctuation. The good news is that by looking at natural strategies, we can completely control those spikes and valleys so that we don't have the risk of high blood sugar and we don't have the devastating effect of low blood sugar either. So, 26 million Americans have diabetes by the official criteria, but when we add the two-hour blood sugar test, we see that that actually goes up to a staggering 40 million of us here in America having diabetes. But for every one of us that has diabetes, at least three, but probably four, have pre-diabetes as well. The problem is that with diabetes, maybe 40%, sometimes 50% of individuals with diabetes aren't aware of it. So there's a lot of us that have diabetes and just simply don't know it. And so how can you fix something that you don't even know about? How can you be motivated to reverse something that you're not aware you have? And so that's why we need to, again, do these other tests so that we can find it. But at least one-third of us, 20 years and older, have pre-diabetes. At least 35, it's actually about 40% of individuals, once we hit 20, we have pre-diabetes. And so once we hit age 40, the majority of us have at least pre-diabetes. In other words, we're in the minority if we don't have pre-diabetes or diabetes once we hit age 40. So that's, an important risk factor for us to pay attention to. If you look at the combination, at least 79 million of adults in the United States have one of the two conditions, pre-diabetes or diabetes. And worldwide, we're looking at about 346 million, and that's a very, very conservative figure. Back in 1956, the bottom left of this graph, the rate of diabetes percentage-wise was only 1%. Move up to 1980, the prevalence of diabetes was only about 2.5%. And you can see how it skyrocketed since the mid-80s to now. The question, what is going on? What is contributing to a condition that while other diseases are in their decline, diabetes is just skyrocketing exponentially? What can we do to be able to say goodbye? By the way, the best way to say goodbye to diabetes is never have to say hello. Can never have to say hello. Get screened early enough so that we can catch it early and reverse whatever condition or whatever level of high blood sugars you might have. Okay, I'm stuck on this slide. If somebody can help me move up. You might have to just shut down, just hit escape, and then just restart the PowerPoint slide. Just hit escape and then restart. Okay, so when we're dealing with pre-diabetes, the problem here is the earliest indication is not being tested for. That's why I like to look at the fasting insulin level. The fasting insulin level is an early indication that the pancreas is having to work hard in order to control blood sugars. Okay, but if we look at the blood sugar the insulin production as a blood test that looks at the insulin production at 1 hour or 2 hours, we see the very earliest indication that the body is having to work too hard to control blood sugars. And so by checking that, by catching that early, maybe 20 to 30 years early than the conventional tests do, we're not only able to never have to say hello to diabetes, but we're also able to prevent all these other conditions that it may be driving, primarily heart disease. Okay, so let's briefly take a look at what I consider to be the recommended lab test. Now, by the way, all these tests are in in chapter 10 of the book that is called Looking at the Big Picture. They're all listed, so this is taken directly from that chapter. And we've already talked about the 4-hour glucose tolerance test. But there's another way that you can do this on your own. Some of us, you know, are kind of like self-made, and we like to kind of check things out on our own before we do a whole bunch of fancy blood tests. I understand that. And for that, for those of us in that category, I created what's called the Pepsi Jelly Bean Challenge. For those of you that grew up watching commercials, you know, between Pepsi and Coke and which was best tasting, I kind of used that as a jumping board for this concept. Not because I promote Pepsi, because I don't, okay? But because oftentimes people would say to me, yeah, I drank that drink in the lab, and man, that was awful. No wonder my blood sugars were high. There's no way I would ever drink anything like that in real life. And so I said, well, it's okay. Why don't you just go ahead and pick your favorite drink, even if it's orange juice or grape juice. Pick your favorite carbohydrates, whether it's sugar cookies or brown rice. Now, I'm not down on brown rice. I'm just saying, if you take 75 grams of carbohydrates, 300 calories, and you ingest it in about 45 minutes to an hour later, check your blood sugars, that's a really good indicator of what's going on in your metabolism. And so the jelly bean challenge came from the fact that many women during pregnancy who have that 3-hour glucose tolerance test, they were given this sweet drink, and you know, they just didn't feel good, and they frequently couldn't hold the drink down. And so researchers and physicians working with pregnant women who had diabetes came up with this new test. This new test where they just eat a whole bunch of jelly beans. That sounds a lot more tasteful than drinking this super saturated glucose drink. Well, so as long as you have 300 to 400 calories of carbohydrates, you can recheck your blood sugars with your home glucose monitoring kit, or borrow one from somebody else. Make sure that you're using a fresh Lancet. Never reuse Lancets, and check your blood sugar. If your blood sugar is starting to rise high at 1 hour, if it goes above 140 at 1 hour, you need to have the full-blown test done. Well, I was teaching a college class at a regional university, and it was a wellness class that was required for all students before graduation. So many of the students in there really, you know, didn't want to be there. So I made sure that I made the class really interesting and practical for them. And not only did it include a comprehensive nutrition and exercise program, but every week we would have debates where they would have to be the debaters, and they'd choose sides and then see which debaters had the most logical explanation of what was best for their health. We debated whether moderate drinking or no drinking was best. Now, I never even told them how I felt about it. I just let them debate. We debated whether sugar or artificial sweeteners were better for them. We debated all kinds of interesting. It's a great learning tool for individuals. But one of the things that we did was the Pepsi Jelly Bean Challenge. And so I said, next class period, I want you to all bring in your favorite drink and your favorite carbohydrate-rich snack. No protein or fat of significance in the snack. And then you're going to drink it at the beginning of class, and we're going to check your blood sugars at the end of class. And they say, well, you know, I don't like soda. I'm trying to stay away from soda. So that's all right. Just whatever you normally do, that's what bring that in. Carbohydrates. And so they did that. And one gentleman, I could tell, because I knew that probably 20% of those college-age students were going to have a significant problem with their blood sugars. I knew it. That's just the statistics. And pretty soon, as my nursing staff went around and checked their blood sugars, I started seeing, you know, white eyes and groans and moans and no way, that can't be right. But one young man, 24 years old, came up to me after class, and you could tell that he was mortified. He was so concerned. He didn't even say anything. He just said, "Dr. Youngberg, take a look at this." And I looked at his blood sugar, and it was 347. He said, "I had no idea that I might even have an early indication of pre-diabetes. But to learn that my blood sugars are well over 200, which is the cutoff for diabetes at a two-hour after a meal blood sugar test." He said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "All of a sudden," he said, I realized that my grandfather's amputation somehow applied to me." See, his grandfather had had out-of-control diabetes for many years, and he had lost actually both legs because of his diabetes. Completely unnecessary. That didn't have to happen. If you would have known what we know today, what's available to us today, that he would have never lost those legs. And says, my Uncle Joe went blind because of his diabetes. And then he had many other relatives who had had heart attacks or strokes, but he had never put that together. You know, one of the biggest risk factors, I should say the biggest risk factor for a heart attack or stroke, is a dysfunctional blood sugar insulin mechanism. Far more important than cholesterol or high blood pressure. Not that those aren't important. It's just that we need to make sure we're paying attention to the greatest risk factors. And so, fortunately, he was in a wellness class, right? So he was smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. He was 35-plus pounds overweight. He was sedentary. He was, you know, working really hard to get it through college and pay his way through college so that he could get a good job. Now, he became very motivated. You know, by the end of that 10-week course, he didn't have diabetes anymore. I even wrote up a lab for him so he could go to the hospital and get checked for all these tests that we're talking about so that he could really understand the big picture for him. But he started a good exercise program. He started a really good nutrition program. By the end of the 10 weeks, he already lost his excess weight. Okay, he realized that I can't smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day and expect to do well. He learned in class that smoking actually creates insulin resistance that causes your blood sugars to go up. So now your pancreas has to make more insulin to control it. Even though most smokers will tend to lose a little weight through smoking, it still increases the insulin resistance. By the way, diabetes is not all about weight. I hear this too often from my physician colleagues. If my patient just lost a little weight, their diabetes would go away. There is a relationship, no question, between the two. But I see many, many individuals that have no weight problem who have pre-diabetes and diabetes. Diabetes and weight are not the same thing. Okay, losing weight isn't the primary goal in reversing diabetes. The primary goal is following a plan that actually improves health so much that not only does your blood sugar go down, but your cholesterol goes down if high, your blood pressure improves if high, and then your weight comes down. Why? Because you're on a healthy plan that's going to help you improve all your risk factors, not just one. And by the way, that is the beauty of attacking diabetes or any condition with lifestyle and nutritional medicine, because it will address all risk factors at the same time, even the things that you're not aware are brewing in your system. What some more serious condition may be developing within you, germinating within you, lifestyle medicine will address that at the same time. Whereas if you just simply choose, well, I'm just going to take my medication and that's going to take care of my risk. Now, I'm not against medications. Don't misunderstand me. What I am against is by misusing medications and thinking that that's going to solve the problem, because it doesn't. Medications do not address the actual cause of the problem, and they never have. Okay? They are a management tool that should be used in sequence after the most aggressive and comprehensive lifestyle nutritional medicine approach. All the guidelines from all the professional medical societies say that relative to diabetes. Lifestyle medicine comes first. The problem is that there hasn't been a comprehensive understanding of how to do that. Just telling somebody to exercise and lose weight isn't going to cut it. It's not enough. So there's many tests, okay, that can encourage us and make us aware of what needs to be done to improve our health. There's the NMR lipid profile. This is actually a nuclear magnetic resonance test on your cholesterol to see how many particles you have of that, quote, bad cholesterol. The particle number, this is a test that's fairly new. It's only been available for the last year, and I'm actually using this instead of the regular cholesterol lipid profile, because not only it gives you all the good and the bad cholesterol, the triglyceride blood fat, but it actually tells you the particle number. Now, I've been really interested in doing this test because I've learned that people who have perfect cholesterol level, I mean a total cholesterol of 160, 180, a LDL cholesterol under 100, that's perfect. A HDL that's above 45 for men, above 55 for women. Triglycerides, the blood fats under 100. I mean, that's a perfect test. In the past, I would say, wow, we don't have to worry about your cholesterol at all. Until I started doing this particle number test, I've had patients who had perfect cholesterol that had very high particle number, which means, and that's the most important of all the tests, okay? Because the more particles you have, the more likelihood of that particle infiltrating into the artery wall and promoting plaque formation. And so those are the things we want to know about. And of course, fortunately, we can use natural approaches to reverse that. The cardiac CRP is a measure of inflammation. Inflammation is what turns on the diabetes genes, the cancer genes, and other unhealthy genes. And so we want to control inflammation, and so that's an important test to do. The hemoglobin A1C, I refer to as the sticky sugar pathology test. It's actually a test to see how much damage has been done in your body because of blood sugar spiking right after meals. I had a patient come to see me. Oh, this is maybe 3-4 months ago. She had just been diagnosed with diabetes, and her fasting blood sugar, which is supposed to be ideally between 70 and 85, was 332. Naturally, she was shocked. She wasn't that overweight. She was maybe only 20 pounds overweight. And she was actually walking 45 minutes every morning. She was already doing more exercise than 90% of Americans. And so she was shocked that her blood sugars were so high. Because if they're that high before a meal, just think how high they went up after the meal. 400, even 500. And so her hemoglobin A1C blood test, which is supposed to be less than 5.0, okay, that's the optimal levels. I don't encourage diabetics to get to that right away. If they're on medicine, they can't get that low. But optimal is less than 5, because any small increase in how much sugar attaches or glazes itself to tissues, to cells in our body, as measured by this test, dramatically increases the risk of complications. We're talking 35% increase in kidney complications and blindness and nerve damage and amputations for even a 1% increase from 5% to 6% on this blood test. And so her percentage at the beginning of her diagnosis was 14.7, and the optimal is at 5.0 or less. You see, after 4.6 on this A1C blood test, the risk of heart disease begins to gradually climb. So once it hits 5 or so, it starts to climb a little faster. And once it hits 7, it climbs even faster. So that is why researchers about 10 years ago said, we're going to use this test even as a diagnostic test. Because this actually, the diagnostic part of this test occurred just a few years ago, where if the A1C is 6.5% or higher, that's officially diabetes. You don't even have to measure another blood sugar. If that's the only thing we find, that's diabetes. If that test is 5.7 up to 6.4, that's pre-diabetes, okay? So there's all kinds of tests that we can use to evaluate where we are. We don't just use that test for people who have diabetes or risk of diabetes. That's a test that we should all have to see, are we sliding in the wrong direction, which represents blood sugar spiking, going up right after the meal. Now, so what did this middle-aged lady do? I suggested to her two primary things. I mean, we did all these tests. We filled in the gaps. I call it finding where the potholes are. Let's just figure out. You know, we're all genetically unique individuals. Let's find out where your potholes are. I have potholes, and I've made sure I've filled them over. And when new tests come out, I take advantage of those tests so I can find other potholes I wasn't aware of, and I fill those in. Okay? And so filling in the gaps medically now helps the body get to a point where it's healing itself. See, we don't have to be super smart about what we're doing. We just have to be consistent about following the mechanism, the strategies of filling in the gaps, taking advantage of the information we learn from these tests. So that's what she did, and she balanced her meals really well. We're going to be looking at that as we breeze through the lifestyle medicine strategies in a few minutes. One of the key strategies is eating a diet that we call first-class foods. In the book, there's a list of three classes of food, which most of us eat some of each of those three classes of food. But if we look at the medical literature and ask which foods are associated with first-class health, with the greatest potential to say goodbye completely to diabetes and other health conditions. And so that's where we came up with the first-class foods. And the goal there is to consume at least 80, maybe 90% of our total diet from first-class foods. It's very doable. I mean, these are healthy, healthy foods. By the way, the number one first-class food is dark green leafy vegetables. Any way you can get those in, enjoy bringing those in on a daily basis. Second is green vegetables, other green vegetables. Third is colorful vegetables. You think vegetables are important? They're powerfully important. Color, you know, the actual color in vegetables doesn't just represent healthy food. It actually is. The color itself is the chemical that helps reverse heart disease and diabetes. It is the chemical that has a specific influence on the gene that turns off the bad genes and literally turns on the good genes, allowing us to literally re-engineer our genetic risk for the better. That's exciting to me. And so that's why if I want to turn on the good genes, I need to eat the healthy plant-based chemicals, those colorful vegetables that actually turn the good genes on and the bad genes off, okay? So, and then the fourth food, I'll stop here because there's so many foods to go over. The fourth most important first-class food is legumes of any kind, beans, peas, lentils of any kind. And my wife spent the morning preparing a salad using garbanzos and other beans. I'm looking forward to here in a few minutes participating in eating that. If you want to bring down your blood sugars or even just the earliest problem with insulin, which so many of us have, or if you just want to lose some weight or improve blood pressure or lower your cancer risk or just feel better, have some type of legumes on a regular basis, at least every other day, but preferably daily. And these legumes will not only improve your blood sugar for that day, excuse me, that after that meal, for the next few hours, but it will also lower your blood sugar response after the next meal, and the next meal, and the next meal. So we're talking 3 meals out into the next day, your blood sugars will spike less because you ate some legumes today at dinner with the doctor. Isn't that good? So make sure you take advantage of some of those foods. Well, she did that, and then I said, one of the key exercise strategies for you is to do some light activity, light to moderate physical activity immediately right after you eat. And so you mean, she said, you mean after I'm done with the dishes and, you know, I have this taken care of and that taken care of, then I go for a walk. She says, no, as soon as you put that fork down or that spoon down, before you clean anything in the kitchen, you go out for a walk. If you can't go outside for any reason, you do something inside. Figure out what's going to work for you. Okay, there's a whole chapter in the book that goes over this in detail and all the other aspects of exercise that are good for us. But my opinion is that the single most important strategy to improve our health is light activity immediately after meals. You know, so what I said to her, I said, because her schedule allowed it, I suggested that she move her 45-minute exercise session that was before breakfast to right after breakfast, and then do about some exercise after lunch and after dinner as well. So, and she went, and then she followed the information on the nutrition chapter to make sure she's balancing every meal effectively. In 6 weeks, she came back with all her blood sugar levels. And you know that her blood sugar levels were now 90% of the time under 100 before meals and under 100 1 and 2 hours after the meal as well, with no medication. See, her doctor had said, you have to go on at least 2 different medications right now. You're out of control. There's no way that you're going to be able to do this without these medications. And she says, you know, I respect your opinions, but give me 2 months. I want to do everything in my power to do this the natural way. He says, I'm going to be upset at myself if I don't give myself the opportunity to do everything that I can. And she says, I'm going to seek out professional advice. So her doctor was just downstairs from my clinic. So she sent her upstairs, and we started working on this. Her A1C was 14.7. Her blood was sugar crystallized. It was really, really high. In six weeks' time, almost completely normal. In 2 months, her hemoglobin A1C had dropped from 14.7 to 6.6, and her fasting blood sugar dropped from 332 to 91. No medications. So in a short amount of time, she had been able to say goodbye to diabetes, because she looked at the broad strategies that focus first and foremost on the meal balancing principles of first-class foods, and secondarily, the aggressive but moderate use of exercise immediately after meals. And she told me, she says, I was doing exercise 45 minutes after breakfast, 20 minutes after lunch, and 25 minutes after dinner. Now, that's a lot of exercise. You know, for those of us who are busy, the typical American gets 0 exercise after meals and 0 exercise any time of the day. That's typical. So any amount of exercise is going to be far better than the average American gets. But, you see, when it comes to reversing a condition, and when we learn about a condition as dramatic as what Mary had with fasting blood sugars of 332, she can't just follow a little baby steps program, try to improve her health. She's floating out with the tide that's going 5 miles an hour, and if she doesn't find a way to make 5 or 6 miles an hour the other direction, she's never going to get to shore. So we have to figure out what is sufficiently powerful enough to get to that tipping point to allow me to actually reverse this condition. So that's why we want to have the advantage of looking at broad strategies that can exponentially increase the benefit of the nutritional program and the exercise program. See, those are the two key pieces of the formula. But by themselves, they oftentimes are not adequate because we have too many potholes on our highway of health that need to be filled in first. And again, that's what the blood test looks. So we got the iron and the ferritin. We got the vitamin D. You know, we could spend 2 hours just talking about vitamin D. We just don't have the time. Powerful in how it regulates blood sugars and improves health. A complete thyroid profile, homocysteine, DHEA, and other hormones. And then for those of us who actually are taking insulin right now and managing our blood sugars with insulin, there's a great test called C-peptide and a stimulated C-peptide that looks to see how well your pancreas right now can produce insulin. We can't measure insulin because then it would mix with the insulin you're injecting, and we don't know if that's really from your pancreas. So we do a different test to see how well your pancreas is working, and that test can help us predict how soon we can say goodbye to diabetes, or if the main goal is actually saying goodbye to the complications of diabetes, which in the end is the most important thing. See, the most important thing is not being able to say goodbye to the diabetes. It's to be able to say goodbye to the complications. That's the only reason we're concerned about blood sugars, is because of the complications that it brings. And we can prevent those from happening if we pay attention to the big picture. Okay, so the challenge with diabetes is that it is a metabolic mess. I don't know. Oh, I see my daughter's in the audience here. I won't look at you, Katie. In the chapter on metabolic mess, I talk about my energetic youngest daughter, Katie. You walk into a room, you go, "Whoa, what happened here?" Okay, it's like a cyclone hit her room, and unfortunately, she has an older sister, Maddie, she's going to be an organizational consultant someday, because she can walk into a room and boom, within 2 or 3 minutes, it would have taken me half an hour to clean that mess, but she's got it all organized. And so diabetes and the imbalances with our metabolism are really like a messy, messy room, only it's a messy internal environment that we live in. And so we need to figure out a way to organize that and to clean it up. Otherwise, it will lead to serious problems. So the key issue then is, what about the fact that if you did an internet search right now, and just in 10 seconds, there's over 200,000 hits on Google. And if you searched for diabetes, you would get over 300,000 hits on Google. But if you search for the potential to cure diabetes, in other words, to say goodbye to diabetes on Google, what would you learn? The first 6 hits in a row will tell you, well, let's ask you this question first. True or false, there is a cure for type 2 diabetes? This is a loaded question. Of course, we've been talking about this now for an hour, but there is a very strong paradigm out there that says that there is no cure for diabetes. See, the first 6 hits are like these. American Diabetes Association says there is no cure for diabetes. U.S. National Library of Medicine, diabetes is a lifelong disease. There is no cure. The Mayo Clinic says there is no cure for type 2 diabetes. These are respected organizations. I am not denigrating them at all. I'm just saying there's a perspective out there that's very different from what I see. Why is that? And I could tell you a whole bunch of stories about that we don't have time to go into today. But let's look at what three very prominent medical doctors in the United States say about diabetes. Dean Ornish, who was the first physician to prove scientifically that you could reverse heart disease in humans. Those of us that paid attention to the research knew it could be done many, many decades ago, because there's been all kinds of data with animals that showed you could reverse heart disease. But for some reason, most doctors were not willing to accept that it had anything to do with us. It can't be done in humans, only everything else. Of course, that wasn't true, and Dr. Ornish was the first to show with evidence-based medical research that heart disease was reversible. What does he say about diabetes? He said, got diabetes? Get rid of it. In other words, we can say goodbye to diabetes if we follow a strategy similar to the strategy that he used to be able to say goodbye to heart disease. See, when I went through my training at Loma Linda University and took gross anatomy where we were cutting up on cadavers, and I see this hard artery going along the heart, and I'm asking my anatomy professor, I says, why is this so hard? And he just looks at me and says, because it's all laden with calcium. That lady had horrible heart disease. And so I remember saying, well, if she would have just known more about diet, maybe she could have reversed that and saved her life. And I remember my professor says, oh, once you got heart disease, there's no way you can get rid of it. And that's not true. I didn't accept it then, but now we actually have evidence that that's not true. So you can get rid of it, only though if you follow a program that gets you to that tipping point. You have to have a broad strategy that allows your body to heal. Otherwise, the continued irritation will lead to progressive disease. Dr. Joel Fuhrman, he says, we won't be controlling type 2 diabetes. We'll be having you become undiabetic, right? Very, very pointed. John McDougall says, a simple cure is possible for essentially everyone with type 2 diabetes. I actually sent him my book to review, and he wrote back. He said, this book should be required reading for all physicians, dietitians, and nurses. He says, following the advice in this book will reverse diabetes. Broad-based. It has to be broad-based or else it won't work. Okay, so one way of understanding this concept, and I'm going to have to be brief here because I'm already using borrowed time, is some of you, you know, that have maybe heard for the last 20, 30 years, my doctor's always told me there's no cure for diabetes. You're going to be on this medicine for the rest of your life. That's true frequently for high blood pressure, et cetera, cholesterol medications. These are lifelong conditions that just have to be managed. Really? Or is it that we're just not following the right strategy to be able to say goodbye to this condition? So this idea of curing diabetes is so controversial that I had to come up with a way to help make it more simple, and that is, if a patient came to me who was 100 pounds overweight, she was definitely obese, but she knew if she lost 100 pounds, she would no longer be obese. She was looking at the height weight table, and so she could see where she was currently and where she could be, and that she would no longer be obese. What if I said to her, she says, well, hold on here. She says, now, I really want to help you lose that 100 pounds, but you're still going to be obese. You can manage obesity. You can't cure obesity. If I said that to her, I hope that she would look at me and say, you're crazy. That doesn't make any sense at all. And likewise with diabetes. See, diabetes is defined by one thing alone, that's how high your blood sugars are, or how high your sticky sugar pathology test is, which relates directly to blood sugar. It only relates to blood sugars, doesn't relate to anything else. Okay, and so if you have out-of-control diabetes like Mary did, And then go to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, I'm really glad you're excited about exercising and diet, but I just want you to understand, you really can't cure this. Do you think that she would have, if she believed that statement, do you think that she would have gone to the effort to reverse diabetes? No, she would. If she would have accepted that message, she would have, you know, packed all her, you know, notes and packed them into her purse and walked home, and, you know, felt defeated. She would now feel like it's fatalistic. There's no purpose in me trying to exercise after every meal and trying to lose weight and eat better. It's just like, I've passed the point of no return, right? See, that's the emotional message that we give to individuals when we say it's not curable. And that's wrong, okay? We need to be empowering a nation to reverse and prevent conditions by saying you not only have the responsibility for your health, but you have the power to change your health and to reverse these conditions. That's exciting to me. That motivates me. And I hope it motivates you. And so that's why I'm speaking about this, but it's not just me. Fortunately, I'm not the only one saying this, because that would be a little tough on me. I have been denigrated in front of large audiences before for saying that. Okay? And fortunately, I was able to keep my mouth shut and not argue. Okay? And that's a story we'll tell you some other time. Actually, it's in the book. It's a powerful story of how I was asked to give a lecture on reversing diabetes with nutrition. And gave it to an audience of 500 doctors and nurses, and the chairman of the scientific community after my talk got up and said, I totally disagree with what Dr. Youngberg just presented. Can you imagine? Okay, but the rest of the story is at another time. Okay, so can you cure obesity? Absolutely. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. Nobody's saying that it's easy. We're saying that curing these conditions is doable if we follow a program that is broad enough to accomplish. I'm hung up on the slide again. So I'm going to have to breeze through these slides to look at. So we're looking at the four D's of diabetes. Okay, defining, debunking, detecting, and now what about defeating diabetes? What are the things that we can do to defeat diabetes? And I've already suggested that the most important one is becoming aware of where we're at, is to get our property. What's the term for when you have to make sure your boundaries? Get your property surveyed. Get your blood test and your body properly evaluated, so you know where the problems are and fix those. With diabetes, the number one treatment, the number one strategy that's going to enable and empower you to reverse diabetes if you have it, or to reverse pre-diabetes if you have it, is to have your own blood sugar monitor and check your blood sugars before in 1 hour or 2 hours after most meals. That's what makes you aware of how powerful exercise after a meal can be. That's what makes you aware of how your food choices so dramatically transform bad blood sugars into good blood sugars. It's a form of biofeedback that's better than anything that you can do. Check your blood sugars. That's what keeps you focused. Okay? The most important thing to understand is that 75% of us have diabetic genes hardwired into our bodies. That is why by the age 65 and over, 3 out of 4 of us have at least pre-diabetes. Did you hear that? 75% of us have pre-diabetes or diabetes by age 65 plus. We got to start paying attention to this. And there's ways to completely reverse that. We can turn off those genes completely. How do we detect diabetes? We've touched on that. I'm going to move right through these. Okay, defeating diabetes. Defeating diabetes, first of all, we need to make sure that we're thinking good thoughts. And in brief, if you don't believe that you can defeat diabetes, you won't. It was Henry Ford who said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Okay, and so what I'm trying to do here is for those of you that are in that category, who already know you're in that category, and for those of us who are not sure where we are, you can defeat this by proper attention to that. Make sure that you're a first-class foodie. Follow the strategies outlined that help you really focus on first-class foods primarily. Then we want to make sure that we go to the next slide, please. Oh, there we go. Make sure that we're taking care of digestion. As I work with patients, I have many patients coming to me for whatever reason, and what we find out is that the main problem is digestion. They're going, why do you come here to work on my digestion? And I said, I understand, but unless we fix this digestive issue, even though you don't seem to have any symptoms for this, you will not get better with this condition. We could spend a whole hour on this alone. It's very, very critical. And that's why I put a whole chapter in the book on fixing digestion. This is critical, especially if you have symptoms of reflux or use Prilosec or other acid-blocking medications. That dramatically increases the risk for whatever you're genetically prone to. And we have to get that fixed or else you're not going to be able to say goodbye to these health conditions. Okay, get a move on. We've talked about the exercise component as being critical. Well, what about weight? It's not all about weight. I already said that. It's about eating healthy food. It's about exercising on a regular basis. And weight will take care of itself. Don't focus on weight as it relates to your health. Focus on health, and that will help you get to a healthy weight eventually. Okay, sound sleep. Those of you who have been coming to dinner with the doctor know that we've talked a lot about the power of sleep. Just having one night where you're not sleeping well causes insulin resistance and a higher blood sugar the next morning. Just one night of inadequate sleep can actually create a scenario which makes you more pre-diabetic, more diabetic, more prone to that. So make sure that you have a good and powerful strategy in mind for sleep. And that's outlined in a critical, critical strategy. And then stay well hydrated. You know, we hear about this all the time. How well are you? How well am I staying hydrated? Just being a little dehydrated increases inflammation in the body, and inflammation is the main trigger of the diabetic gene, but also the cancer genes and the heart disease gene. So make sure you still stay well hydrated. By the way, the number one tip for hydration is when you first wake up, take a tall mug of warm to hot water. Add a little lemon if you want and drink that down. First thing you do in the morning, that is the most powerful strategy to regulate digestion, to prevent and treat constipation, to detox the system, but also to de-stress the system and to reset the system in a healthy way. Drinking a large mug, basically 12 to 20 ounces of pure water, and then the rest of the day, mid-morning, 30 minutes before lunch, mid-afternoon, 30 minutes before dinner, try to get more cold water at that time to stay well hydrated. Okay, soak up the sun. We talk frequently about that. Get some sun every day. I hope you got some sun today. It was a good day for it. I got at least 30 minutes of outdoor sun, and I really helped make you feel better. Then finally, we're looking at first, second, and third-line therapies. First-line therapies are the things that we've been alluding to already, all the lifestyle and nutritional factors that influence our health so powerfully. But then there's second-line therapy, and this is where I put appropriate nutritional supplementation. There's no question that those of us that are prone to pre-diabetes, to insulin resistance, to diabetes, have greater nutritional requirements. There's no question about that. Even the average American is very low in magnesium. The average American is low in various nutrients. So we need to optimize that. And so actually put a whole chapter in the book into looking at optimizing nutritional strategies using supplementation. Is it a substitute for a healthy diet? No, it cannot be. There is no substitute for a healthy diet. There's no way that I could even with the knowledge we have today, put together a supplementation program that will come close to the powerful benefits of a whole plant-based diet. It can't come close to it. But there's many benefits of supplementing to that with a healthy minerals and vitamins and omega-3 fatty acids. And so that's really critical that we pay attention to that. And then third-line therapy is where we bring in the prudent use of pharmaceutical medicines to make up the difference of what we're not able to do with first and second-line therapy. So that's how I see first, second, and third-line therapy. And then we need to fight the hidden culprits. And I'll just speak briefly on this, but there's many individuals, they're doing everything else, and they're still having problems with high blood sugars and other health problems. What's going on there? That suggests that there may be a subtle autoimmune process occurring. There may be a subtle toxicity occurring, that we need to help the body get rid of those toxins. We need to help the body fight and destroy those low-grade infections. And so that's really important. That has to be done clinically, and you need to have the support of a knowledgeable healthcare professional to address that. And then, of course, reaching out for help, seeking the advice of the appropriate people that can guide you in this process. And as we end here, this is a critical, critical concept. Whenever I work with patients, I say to them, I am so glad that you have chosen me to be one of your board of directors for your health plan. I am one on your board of directors for your personal health improvement. Okay. But you are the chairman. You are the chairwoman of your health. You're ultimately in charge, and you're ultimately responsible for every decision that is made. Never let anybody else tell you that you don't know what you're doing and you need to follow my advice. Okay, you need to research this for yourself and come up with and ask advice from everybody on your board, all your other healthcare team members, and then decide what is best for you. Because unless you're willing to be the chairman of the board, you're never going to be able to say goodbye to anything. Okay? Thank you for your attention tonight. And join me for the dinner part of Dinner with the Doctor. And hopefully we'll have some time for question and answers towards the end. And if any of you are interested in the Goodbye Diabetes book or Karen Houghton's Naturally Gourmet Cookbook, that is also available at the where we will be having our dinner. So just, in fact, why don't we just have a word of prayer for the food first to get that accomplished, and then we'll dismiss. Let's bow our heads. Father, I want to thank you for the opportunity to have so much information available to us today. There's so much scientific progress, so much information that if we just started putting it into practice, we could see tremendous gains in our health. So, Lord, I just pray that you send the Holy Spirit to touch the heart of each one of us here today, to give us a sense of empowerment, a sense of not just awareness, but a desire to do what is best for our health, and so that we can then be most effective for being a helpful to those around us and in your causes, Lord, I pray. And thank you for this food that is about to be served. In Jesus' name, amen.